And welcome back. We get to go down to Las Vegas now and spend an hour with one of the most wonderful people I've ever had the honor of knowing, and many of you feel the same way, even if you haven't talked to him directly. He's brought so much laughter and levity and fun and humor and happiness into this ever more depressing planet over his wonderful career than anyone I can even imagine. Hello, Johnny. Welcome back.
Jeff, that is so sweet of you, you know, and I have put together, I hope, a really interesting show to you tonight, because I feel rather down and a little bit sad that I won't be able to do shows with you for 2 months after tonight, because I have something that I have to finish by the middle October, but I think I have put together some stuff that you will absolutely love. First off, what I would like to do is give a warning to people who live in Las Vegas about scam artists, and one of them hit me today of all days. Then I'd like to talk a little bit about the Paris Olympics. I have two unbelievably adorable stories about Sarita, and I have a great story about the day I discovered how stupid I was, which is going to inform a lot of people. And then I get scores and scores of letters from people on how to become a writer. And so one of them was from the best writer I know, who lives in Serbia. English is her second language. Her name is Alexander Miletic. And so I would like to be able to read that advice, because I think it's terrific. Now, the other thing, when we have done 25 minutes, did you get my Facebook post, which I keep saying is the last post I'm ever going to put up, called John Barber's Last Word on the November Elections?
Yeah, it's up. It's posted, yes.
Oh, well, thank you. What I would love to do, is when we have about a half an hour left, since it's 18 minutes long, maybe 25 minutes left, I would love to be able, first of all, tell the audience why I did that. I think it is one of the most brilliant things I have ever written. Pardon me for saying that. I would like to take the time to tell them very shortly why I did it. It's 18 minutes long. It's already had 2,000 hits in a day and a half. And when it's over, there are a lot of things about it that you may not like at all. And you may be glad to see me gone for 2 months.
Oh, come on.
Anyway, could we do that? Could we do the show that way?
You want to play that 18 minutes after a half an hour? Yeah, we can do that.
Okay, so let me tell you first the public servant thing about scam artists in this town. They are so good at what they do. One of them hit me today. But it's the first time was about 2 years ago. Sarita and I were at Caesar's Palace. And we had a wonderful dinner, got on the elevator. We're next to a very attractive couple. Was welcomed us aboard, said hello, wanted to know how they did gambling. We did gambling, and they had a big bucket of silver coins, and they were flipping them up and down and just... They were so attractive. Then they dropped the coins on the floor of the elevator. So Sarita and I dived down and start picking them up and putting them in the bucket and handing. And they thanked us so profusely and said, "Drive safely going home." So we get home, and Sarita empties her purse, and there's no wallet. They find it the next day in the garbage can in the parking lot. And the management at Caesars said, "Well, they must have left you a lot, because ordinarily they take the complete wallet." They left it so you could find it, but there was nothing there. Everything of value was gone. Now, today, hold this. I go to Albertson's Market, and Sarita and I have four different accounts, and we keep a modest account under $1,200 in one account for little groceries and hitting golf balls and stuff like that. And that's what I buy groceries with. So I'm at the Albertson grocery store to Warm Springs in Eastern. I spend $179 for groceries.
And had one half of a shopping bag full,
that's
right?
That's just what I was going to say. Oh. But the interesting thing about it, there was the place was mobbed, and there were only two lines open, and the line behind me was not open. But standing behind me was a really attractive couple, both dressed in white. My God, white hats, white suits. They looked just beautiful. And so I used one of the credit cards that has the lesser amount for the groceries. I inserted no cash and put in my PIN and put it back in my wallet. I'm holding my wallet in my hand. And I wheeled the half a cart full of empty of groceries, you say, take it to the car, and I open the car door. And this gorgeous couple comes toward me, and the guy's holding out a $20 bill. And they say in this beautiful accent, "Oh, Mr. Barber." Mr. Barber. Superman. They called me both. "This $20 bill fell out of your wallet." And I said, "Well, I don't carry money in my wallet. I carry it in a separate purse and in my back pocket." "No," he said, "open your wallet. You see it fell out of your..." Now, like an idiot, I opened the wallet. I know I never carry money. And he says, "Here, now put it back." So I open my wallet to put it back, and the lady bumps me, and I drop the $20. But I'm holding my wallet in my left hand, open. I bend down, pick up the $20, and I put it in there. And I thank them very, very much. I said, "Hey, you could have been just thieves and kept the $20. I mean, little did I know that I was undercalling them thieves.
That's funny. Who bumped you, John?
The lady bumped me, but she's not hard, but she's right. She's
just enough. Okay.
Left rear, just enough, and he's in front of me. And I'm holding, I'm not even looking now. I'm looking at the guy and holding my wallet up by my left hand, almost over my shoulder, so I can put the $20 bill in. Anyway, I am smart enough. Every day, five or six times a day, I check all of my accounts to see how they are. So I go in and I find out that this account is empty. They took $800 out at an ATM machine. They had spotted me putting in my PIN. So, of course, I call Wells Fargo.
Now, this is a couple in white.
In white, I mean, they were
dressed
gorgeous.
Angelically, and they watched you put in your PIN.
Yeah, certainly they did. They had to.
Jeez.
And they were they knew the color of the card. They knew which one to take. So, in any event, I call Wells Fargo.
$800. Huh.
Yeah, and I tell Wells Fargo, I said, "Listen, you know from my history, I never take out more than $200 from an ATM machine. And so they're gonna challenge it. Maybe in 10 days, I might get it back. I might not, as long as I file a police report." I said, "Listen, I play golf with detectives. They can tell worse stories than I'm telling you." And she said, "Well, if you file a police report, there is a possibility you may be able to get it back." And she said, "If you look at your phone, Mr. Barber, you might see it says pending." And I said, "Well, it's gone. It just says
nothing pending about it." No.
Yeah, so I'm just telling people, when you're in this town, don't let anybody get close to you, no matter how nice they are, because they're going to rob you. And I shouldn't be giggling like this, but I am.
Well, they dress like angels, and they put you at a disadvantage right away. You thought, how nice, how clean, how pure. How pure in spirit are they.
But you want to know something. Sarita never lets anybody get close to her at all, except for that accident that happened when they spilled the coins there, because a couple of times she's been by her car and a guy has come over, really handsome looking guy that's walking towards her, and she puts up her arm to stop him. She says, "Don't come any closer." He said, well, I just wanted to have a little chat. She said, I don't chat with anybody. So anyway, did you watch?
You have to do that. Sarita, you're very smart. You have to do that now. You have to protect yourself. You can't play games.
She's so much smarter about people than I am. And that will be revealed in one of the stories I'm going to tell you about her. Oh, my God, how smart. Anyway, did you watch any of the Olympics?
No.
Well, you say
yet. Nine.
Okay, no. So you say no like you hated what you watched.
It's a depravity. The Olympics are dead. How are you going to rehabilitate something like that? Disgusting.
Well, and obviously watch the opening, or a little bit of it. So I just want to say
a little bit.
Okay, yeah. I'll just say this. After a very embarrassing opening ceremony, Jeff, I watched very little of the Paris Olympics. The only two things I did watch were golf and gymnastics.
Is golf an Olympic sport, John?
Yes, it is. Golf is by far the greatest sport ever invented. You have no partner. You do not play against anyone. You play against only yourself, against the golf course, and against history. You could be the biggest jerk in the world, but if you can put the ball in the hole, you can feed your family.
Gotcha.
It was a delight to see that someone who is definitely not a jerk, but a really, really smart, generous human being, Scottie Scheffler, takes gold for America. With the Senior Champions Tour, it is the only sport one can play for a lifetime. And at 91.
That's an interesting point.
With team sports like football's Inflategate years ago, sadly, the outcome is often determined by referees.
Yeah.
I watched the gymnastics, Jeff, because in a very short lifetime of dedication, deprivation, and hard work, it shows what the perfectly conditioned human body is capable of doing. These artists, winners or losers, are a joy to watch, especially in slow motion. I mean,
I'm sure the coverage was pretty amazing. And again, what you just said is, yeah, that's slow motion. That would really be amazing. I agree.
Okay, so now this is another thank you to my favorite writer, one of the best writers I know. Her name's Alexandra Miletic. She's a genius movie buff and brilliant writer friend. In Serbia, she reminded me that the brilliant, brilliant actress, Gina Rowlands, died on the 14th of this month. It reminds me, Jeff, of a long-forgotten story, I will tell you now. An absolutely fantastic, fantastic actress. The wife of John Cassavetes, who directed her in one of her best films, a gangster film called Gloria. Also co-starring a terrific young actor named Jack Adams. The boy's entire family is slaughtered by mobsters looking for a book about their business. Gloria saves the boy, and the rest of the film is a fantastic, adventuresome, often funny romp of the two of them together on the run. It was one of my wife Sarita's favorite films, one which she memorized nearly all the dialogue.
And I
knew John from having interviewed him twice on the morning show on ABC in Los Angeles. Sarita was movie star beautiful. She was hit on by every major male in the business. As a result of that and a self-sufficient personality, enjoying her own company, she stayed to herself. More than once a week, we would dine at Musso and Frank's historic restaurant on Hollywood Boulevard in a special corner table assigned to us near the bar. One afternoon at lunch, in comes John with his agent, walking by our table to say hello to me, but not to Sarita. He continued on sitting in the next booth.
Now, this is John Cassavetes. I want people to know that. Roland's husband. All right.
Yes. He did not look well. His skin, Jeff, was yellow. Sarita noticed it, saying he did not look well. And would I mind if she went over to talk to him? I said, of course not. She walked over, extended her hand, introducing herself, thanking him for making Gloria, then quoting a few lines. He howled, a happy laugh that filled the room, then grabbed her by the hand and did not let go for at least 20 minutes as she stood and he sat and they talked and talked. Saying goodbye, he thanked her and kissed her hand. She returned to the table, tears in her eyes, and thanked me. Of course, I told her that she'd made him monumentally happy, happier than any star or director would ordinarily get. 3 weeks later, though, he died. One of the things that I have loved about Alexandra and Serbia is she often posts simple pictures and dates of births and deaths of famous actors or actresses, European, American, who often don't get even a mention in their own countries. I cannot thank her enough for her modest mention of Gina Rowlands, because it sparked in me a treasured memory of one of the short stories that I had to edit out of my 1,000-page autobiography, Your Mother's Not a Virgin. To get it down to the publishers requested 752 or so. I am also reminded and enormously grateful to Alexander. From out of nowhere, she was one of the very first people, Jeff, to give my autobiography a 5-star rave review.
Nice.
Another memory I treasure, and Sarita will be absolutely thrilled to watch again and again, even if it's on her phone, thanks to Alexandra's thoroughness in posting it on YouTube. So Sarita has been watching that. So anyway, that story I took
out. That's a good one.
Well, this is another story about Sarita. Do you mind if I tell it?
Well, you better.
Oh, okay.
I don't want you getting in trouble. You tell all you want about Sarita. That's good.
I wrote it after... I wrote a very charming story about Bob Goulet when I was his opening act, and we were together at the Comedians Golf Tournament, which I won't get into. It's in my book. This story is not quite in my book, but probably should be. So I posted it because so many people like my story about Bob Goulet. I'm now going to tell you about John Gary. No one in the world sang Danny Boy or explained it more beautifully than he did. It was early January 1969. Sarita was 9 months pregnant. I was John's opening act at the Fremont Hotel in downtown Las Vegas.
John Gary had a very interesting high voice, very interesting range. Go ahead.
Yes, lyric baritone, beautiful. At the same time, I was under, as a matter of fact, when I finished my act, I never went backstage. I stayed out front to listen to him. Anyway, at the same time, I was under contract at Westinghouse to replace Merv Griffin, who was moving mistakenly to CBS to go up against Carson. Should I get the hosting job replacing him, my producer was to be a young, handsome, slender Roger Ailes, who ended up going on Orson Welles' diet and becoming the womanizing head of Fox News. Of course, he came to Vegas to watch my act and chat with me in general. The part of my act he loved the most and came back night after night to listen to and watch was when I talked about Sarita's being 9 months pregnant and crap players surrounding her wanting to touch her tummy for luck. At one point, one of the heaviest bettors asked her if she'd throw the dice for him. She said she would try, then asked the pit boss if he would mind. Everyone cheered. Many in the casino came to see what was going on. They started to mill around. So the bettor made a very large bet, and the dealer asked one of the gamblers to hand the dice to her because she had a hard time getting close to the table. As she held the dice, she asked innocently, "Why is this game called craps?" Everyone giggled. They howled when the guy who handed her the dice to roll for the big bettor said, "You'll know why, lady, if you roll snake eyes for this guy and see what he does in his pants." They howled. But Sarita looked like she swallowed a watermelon, a feeling she loved, and could not get close enough to the table to throw the dice. So I asked the dealer if he would mind if she just backed into the table and threw them over her shoulder. The gamblers cheered. They were having so much fun. The dealer could not say no. So she turned her back to the table, tossed them over her shoulder, and up popped seven. Laughter and applause from everyone, and a huge win for the bettor, who let it ride. They rushed to get the dice back into her hand, and this time, up pops 11. Another monster win, and cheering and laughter so loud, almost the entire casino walks over to see what all the screaming is about. As she gets ready to toss them again, a drunk walks by, looks at her, and almost yells, "Damn it, why that hunchback? He can't even see the table for damn hair in his eyes."
There was a
volcanic eruption of laughter and yelling that was so much, it was almost impossible to continue. The bettor picked up his huge stash, tipped the dealers generously, walked over to Sarita to give her a bundle of chips, which she declined, saying, "Thank you very much, but I have a better bundle here," and patted her stomach. Cheering and cheering. He asked if he could do the same, and she said, "Ma'am, I have the very strong feeling that you're going to have much better luck than I just had. God love you." An ovation as Sarita and I walked away hand in hand. The bettor was right. On January 29th, 1969, just a week later, Sarita gave birth to her 9-pound, 8-ounce son, Christopher Ernest Barber. We hit the child's jackpot, even to this day.
Well, another wonderful story. These are little vignettes that should be on a big screen.
Well, anyway.
Think about it. That'd be fun.
Okay,
all right, we need to play your video here. I think we should start.
Okay, great. And then afterwards, I have something here about the day I became... how much time do we have? A half an hour?
We have 25 minutes from right now. We'll have 7 minutes after the video.
Then I might have, okay, hang on a second. Now I'm going to read to you. You're going to play the video and I'll introduce it.
I'm ready to go right now, whatever you want to do.
Hang on, let me say this and then play it, okay?
Yeah.
When I was a comedian, I wrote for an audience. But now that I'm just a guy writing on Facebook, I write for myself. In 1967... someone had to investigate and solve the murder of John Kennedy. That someone was Jim Garrison. And for some amazing, amazing reason, Mr. Garrison chose me to be his Boswell, to tell his courageous, heartbreaking, historic story in two definitive documentaries. Now, someone has to say something about America today and about the November presidential elections. And somehow, even though I hate politics, the fates have chosen me. This, as promised before, is going to be my last Facebook post. And in all modesty, thanks to the genius of Stu Shostak, this is one of the things I'm proudest of ever having written. Please enjoy. Thanks, Jeff.
Play. Very good. All right, here we go.
What's up, Doc?
What's up? A cartoon election. Hi, this is John Barber. And please forgive me for wearing these dark glasses, but my son came to Las Vegas for a couple of days and we went out to Boulder Creek and played in 106 degree heat. And I am half blind, so I have to wear these with the bifocals to read what it was that I wrote. So let's get going. And in getting going, I'm going to tell you, I hope, honestly, that this is the very last time I'm going to be posting on Facebook, because I have something else that for decades I've wanted to do. It's a promise that I've wanted to keep to myself, and it's an absolute bitch that I can't even keep that promise to myself. But I am compelled to write this because a dozen and a half of my very, very best friends who are very successful executives in either banking or owning their own businesses are going to vote for Donald Trump. And not one of them would hire Trump either as a co-executive or a fucking doorman. They are all 1,000 times smarter than that and smarter than him. And they are a lot more considerate than he is, because those who are not married wear condoms. So why is it that all these very bright, successful men are voting for somebody not only a whole lot dumber than they are, but who was also a lot less successful in business? And they say to me, because they're afraid she's a socialist, not because she's a woman, when they haven't the foggiest idea what a socialist is. There is no left in America. The last surviving socialist is Bernie Sanders, and he's a political eunuch. If my friends have not read Karl Marx, they haven't the foggiest idea about what industrialized, unchecked capitalism did to destroy families in England in the 1800s. All of this was exposed in Karl Marx's first book, Das Kapital, published in 1867, and financed by a millionaire, Frederick Engels, one of the oligarchs and the insiders who knew the corruption and the destruction caused by this industrialization in England, and wanted it changed also, otherwise he knew it would change his country. It was like Gore Vidal in America for decades, one of the one percenters who for decades and decades told us about the corruption at the top and how it was totally unchangeable. To say socialism is satanic is like saying champagne tastes like shit when you haven't even tasted it. So right now, I am going to lead you to a well of facts. Now, I can lead you to these facts, but I cannot make you think. And I cannot make you change your mind, because I have no intention of doing that, because I have seen that more adults in America change their mates before they change their mind. And it doesn't cost a nickel when you change your mind. So let's get back to the beginning. Jesus belonged to a sect called the Essenes. They owned everything in common. Ergo, Jesus was a socialist. When Christopher Columbus got lost looking for a route to China and was saved when he bumped into the Indians in the Caribbean islands, Indians who lived off of what came out of the trees and off the land, knowing nothing about private property. But Columbus, to teach them the value of private property, chopped off 1,000 hands. And what did capitalist America do? They gave Chopping Christopher a holiday. American Indians were socialists, again sharing and living off of what Mother Earth gave them. If you are living off of or paying into Social Security, that is a socialist program instituted by Henry Wallace, FDR's vice president, during the horrifying, almost destroying American Depression. A depression that almost brought about a Russian-style revolution, but it was saved from this by the programs of Henry Wallace. Not only Social Security, but an 8-hour workday, the right to join a union, no child labor, and the beginning of Medicaid. All socialist programs. And what happened to Henry Wallace? There was an attempt by a dozen bankers headed by George Bush's grandfather to assassinate FDR, whom they thought was a socialist. This attempt was to be led by General Smedley Butler, who ratted on them and informed FDR, but FDR didn't have the fucking brains to execute them and cut their heads off. Surviving, they gathered together the other oligarchs and bankers, and they got rid of Wallace because they were afraid he would become, if FDR died in his third term, a socialist president. Third term. That is why we now only have two terms. The oligarchs wanted Harry Truman, who could create the Central Intelligence Agency and the security state in 1947, after earlier dropping two unnecessary atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Thus began the real decline of democracy in America, a loss of the First Amendment and real free speech under Bill Clinton, the worst president in American history, the loss of the Fairness Doctrine under Ronald Reagan. The worst loss of all, though, is the loss of hope that was embodied in John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, John Lennon, all slaughtered in public execution like Caesar in Rome as a public warning. Unregulated capitalism in America has become legalized greed. The perfect society, the one that Jesus and Karl Marx and Dr. King and our Thomas Jefferson envisioned, is one in which no company or no individual should be under the financial or physical control of any other individual or company. In America, that is absolutely not the case. Over 300 million Americans are handcuffed by debt by the need to have two parents get two jobs to support a small family. The oligarchs, the handful of families that own this country, as George Carlin warned us about, is a club to which we do not belong. They also have the clubs of the military to see that other countries do not develop a socialist philosophy of sharing. Sharing sets a bad example to America's owners. So as they murdered our leaders, whom we hoped desperately would change this corrupt system, the CIA now travels around the world to murder popularly elected socialist leaders. In the 1950s, Eisenhower ordered the CIA to murder Mossadegh, a teacher who wanted to nationalize his oil for his own country and his own people. In Chile, Nixon and Kissinger orchestrated the murder of Chile's popularly elected socialist Salvador Allende because he was going to nationalize some of America's companies to give the jobs to Chileans. And then, of course, there was that wicked witch of the North, Hillary Clinton, cackling like a hyena over the murder of Gaddafi in Libya, who did not build his own home until everyone else in the country not only had a home, but a job, a free education, and free medical assistance. And the same with the CIA's criminal, clumsy attempts to also get rid of Castro, who was smarter than the whole goddamn bunch of them. On September 5th, 1981, when I asked Jim Garrison why he thought he could take on the federal government, he said, "John, I guess I thought I was living in the country I was born in." I became a citizen in 1977 after years and years of struggle and two deportation. America is not the country to which I became a citizen in 1977. In the 64 years I have been in this country, which gave me a fantastic life, a fantastic career, and a fantastic family, I have accurately predicted every presidential election, but only voted once, mistakenly, for Obama. A vote for anyone in this election is a vote for a lesser evil. So why continue the criminal corruption of this evil? This is a great, wide land occupied by refugees like myself from all around the world. And evil is still an evil. As for this November, I hate to tell some of my friends this, but Harris is not only going to win big, but she's going to win by a mudslide. Not because she's not evil, because any politician connected with this criminal system has no choice but to be evil, but she is not Donald Trump. Trump loved it when he could take on Biden, who once in a while had a difficult time talking. Trump has become the Republicans' Biden. His trying to put three comprehensive, simple sentences together is like watching a one-legged man trying to walk on a rolling ball. Donald Trump talking is like a verbal shell game. And you're looking, well, where's the nut? Well, the nut is indeed Donald Trump. But he's not so nutty to realize that he is not going to win this election, so he is already planning his next January 6th insurrection. When I look at Donald Trump, I am reminded of that wonderful, funny film, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, in which Steve Martin is trying desperately to get John Candy to say something that had a point. He would say to him, listen, if you're going to tell a story, make sure it has a fucking point about it so that we can get to the end. Donald Trump can't get to the point ever again. In the late 1970s, when I was a writer and a performer on the revival of Laugh-In, writing mostly for Frank Sinatra, one of the little things that we used to write for the show, and especially for Sinatra, were epitaphs of very famous people. Epitaphs on their tombstones. Now, at the time, the most popular person, I guess, in America was Richard Nixon. So the epitaph I wrote for him was, here lies Richard Nixon, and lies, and lies. That could absolutely be the same tombstone for Donald Trump. However, being a writer, I hate to repeat myself. So here is my new tombstone for Donald Trump. Here lies Donald Trump. He debated Kamala Harris. The one thing that disappointed me a little bit about Biden was he lacked some balls. Now, Donald Trump, we all know, went around saying he's going to be a dictator. Everybody realized that, and he could get away with crimes he commits as a president because of a ruling of his Supreme Court. And he was going to be a dictator. But he still wasn't president. The president was Joe Biden. So I suggested, before he gave it up, that he grab himself by the balls, screw his scourge to the sticking point, and become a dictator for the day. And then have the military arrest this son of a bitch, already convicted of 34 crimes, but not arrested by the police or the CIA, but by the military, and sent to Guantanamo, where there is no civilian release. So that disappointed me about Joe, okay? But I'm telling you something. That will be not the case with Kamala. Kamala has the balls to be a dictator for a day. So, good luck to all of us.
Yes, a perfect commentary and a perfect ending. I would say that tagging anything you've done by saying this is the greatest thing you've ever done is doing an injustice to your brilliance. You have done so many things, John, that are really uncountable. They're brilliant. So it's a wonderful thing you posted. You've always expressed yourself so well and so wittily and so whimsically that people can't help but like it, even if they disagree.
Do we have 5 minutes? Because
we do.
I want to cut it out. I say, this is the day that I discovered that I was stupid. Okay. Oh, my God, the day that you discover you're an idiot along with the experts. I am type 2 diabetic. With diet and meds, I keep it well in hand. But for the last 2 weeks, my high blood sugar, I could not understand. Before going to Washington, D.C. Film Festival, my blood sugar was a perfect 94. Back home with first prize and my pills, it was 350.
Ouch.
Knocking me to the floor. Rushing to the hospital, waiting hours, filling out forms, a shot of insulin I got, sending me home. It just came down a little, but my bank balance a lot. Still at 250, I had to return for a day. Testing, blood, urine, x-rays in every position. Finding no cause, they handed me papers and a bill telling me to see my primary physician. So I called him today. Friday, he's gone till Tuesday. But I could see his nurse. Jesus Christ, you're kidding. Dealing with medicine in America is a fucking curse. Desperate, filling out forms on the internet, she saw me as promised at 2 o'clock. My Superman sweater was older than her. I relaxed knowing there was absolutely, absolutely nothing she could do. She was pretty and slender, took my blood pressure and took my weight, looked at the hospital's papers at me saying, "For 91, you look more than great." I thanked her, saying I only felt concerned. She asked me if I felt any ills. I said none. And if it weren't 106 outside, I'd be playing golf. She chuckled and asked to see my pills. Dumping my bag of three bottles, she looked at each. "Mr. Barber, I think you've made a mistake." I said, "How could I?" She said, "The metformin's here. Where's the diabetes medicine you take?" "In the two smaller bottles," I said. "No, that's lovastatin for cholesterol," she said. "No wonder Superman's so thin." "Are you kidding me?" I screamed. "What an idiot." Her perfect teeth sparkled through that perfect grin. "What an idiot," I repeated. "Mr. Barber, you are not an idiot. You're 91. I laughed out loud. She then asked if I could remember how long it had been since my mix-up meds had begun. I told her I couldn't remember when, 6 months maybe, but I could remember the name, Glyperide. "Do you remember where it is?" she said. "I take one daily." "You must lead a charmed life, Mr. Barber. I have patients, Les Lusky, missing meds like you did. They're dead now." "Do you mind if I call you Melissa?" "Not at all. And give you my card? I have seen your outstanding work. Now I'd like you to see mine." "Oh," she said, "I'll look at your site right away. Melissa, at times, I'm a half-ass writer who likes to write rhyme. I'll try to ad-lib this for you. This is how mysteriously my luck does grow. About solving my condition, not one expert or doctor did know. But Melissa, at the bottom of the medical totem pole, I accidentally found you and a cure, Melissa. You are intervention divine." "Oh, Mr. Barber, it was the warmest two-handed handshake I ever had. Just amazing."
That's nice. I hope she has a copy of this.
You know what? I should go by and give it to her.
You should. I
must tell you, I posted that. That got a huge, huge response, almost as much as the essay that I just did now. So, anyway,
your rhyme writing is is really wonderful. It always is. And so that's another thing you do. Now, listen, we won't talk to you until after Trump has been sentenced and after until after the election has been held.
Hey, listen to me. The judge...
Hurry up, John. We have 15 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay, put it off till September, middle of September. He said, if required. Those
he did.
Words, if required means...
I remember.
He might overturn the guilty verdict of 12-person American jury.
Anything's possible. I agree.
I don't know.
It's crazy.
Anything's possible in America.
Yeah. All right. Well, you take care. Give Tarita a hug. And we'll talk soon, and I'll watch for your email if you have anything to let me know. If I can help, let me know that, too.
Well, you know what I would love to do, because I'm going to miss you so much. Donald's going to be on Monday, right?
Yeah.
Do you think you and Donald would mind if I came on? Because he is the second best writer I know.
We will do it. We'll call you Monday.
I just want to read... advice on how to be a writer.
We'll do it on Monday.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, Johnny.
Great weekend. Thank you again. Thank you. Thank you.
Bet. Okay. Good night. All right, Mr. B. All right, we will take a little break here and be back Monday with John and Don and lots of other things. So have a good weekend. Think about preparing. Things are really getting to that point now where you have no choice. Be safe, be well, and we'll talk soon.